listening to the podcast of Eucharist Church in San Francisco, a community of faith seeking to live all of life in reference to Christ. Join us now for a roundtable discussion centered on the book, The Relational Soul, by Richard Plass and James Cofield. This series is part of The Deep End, a 10-week exploration of what it looks like to live lives in relationships of deep connection. Welcome back. You're listening to the podcast of Eucharist Church. I'm John Trammell. With me here is Father Ryan Jones and Elizabeth Jones. And this is episode 3 of the series we're doing called The Deep End, where we're discussing a book called The Relational Soul by Richard Plass and James Cofield. We're just going to dive right in here to discussing chapter 3. How are you guys?
We're doing great.
Doing well. We're a little tired. We've been traveling, so we're dealing with a little bit of jet lag, but we're back in the saddle again.
Elizabeth, you're doing well?
Doing great, yeah. Our toddler is active as ever in the midst. He is never tired unless it's really nap time, and then he's very tired. But anyways, yes, doing good.
Well, we had a little bit of feedback from one of our listener. We've gotten some emails from some of you who are listening, and this one email, we asked the listener if we could share some of this, and it was some really good thoughts. Elizabeth, would you mind sharing what you received?
Absolutely. So this is from somebody named Laura, and she lives in Silicon Valley. We'll call her Laura of Stanford to coin her name. But anyways, she sent this very, very interesting email in. She's writing in response to the first podcast, where we're talking about kind of the relationality of the universe. So she writes, "Just as we're relational beings because we are created in the image of a relational God, you are articulating something about how our universe itself is relational. One aspect of this is some sort of distinctness bound up in community pattern, for lack of a better catchphrase, which shows up everywhere, i.e. cells in the body, people in community. One of my most favorite examples of this distinctiveness bound up in community pattern comes from physics and is known as color confinement. Atoms are made up of protons and neutrons and electrons, and protons and neutrons are made up of quarks. Modern physics considers quarks to be fundamental. So what are quarks like? Quarks live in deep community. The three quarks that make up a proton or neutron are bound so tightly that even though they are distinct, they are totally inseparable. In fact, when you try to separate two quarks, just when they hit the breaking point, rather than separating, a quark and anti-quark pair spontaneously is created so that the quarks are always in community while they exist. I like that there is this appropriate tension between the individual and the community at the most basic levels of matter. And I'm glad, but maybe not surprised, that we don't live in a universe where Democritus is Adam, which seems to exist as an individual apart from community as the fundamental building block of matter." Anyways, that's her email, which we thought was
pretty interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I'm not a physicist, but just to think about the structure of the universe in that sort of way gives us a different picture of the cosmos we live in.
What I find interesting was this idea that when something happens that causes them to be out of parity or out of sync with one another, that they sort of autocorrect themselves. Hmm. That in order to remain in a healthy and whole community, they'll switch. I think it was polarity that she said, like that they'll switch themselves in order to remain in relational wholeness with one another. It's fascinating.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the reason it resonates so deeply is because it echoes some of the Trinitarian nature that we think of being behind the whole material universe. And so I guess we shouldn't be surprised by all that, but it's very interesting.
Well, I think it is it feels surprising to us because we think of the universe as kind of matter, hmm, right? And then there's these other soulful things apart from matter. But this book is so oftentimes talking about how, no, you know, a baby is being nursed, or you're smiling at your child, like all these very kind of
mundane
Yeah, like feeding, you know, it doesn't get much more mundane than feeding, or doesn't get much more exciting than feeding, depending on how you look at it. But, you know, it's, but
depends
these,
on which perspective the baby or which yours. Eating.
Right, right. But these mundane things, everyday things actually are like really infused with a relational.
So like the relationality is not something we are supplying or projecting onto reality. It's actually there. At the deepest level,
right.
Is really what Laura was trying to say in her email there.
Right, Laura's saying, no, actually matter at its fundamental level, at the quark level, only can exist in community. Like, it doesn't exist
individual
apart.
Intention with community and together, right? And
there's well, like but that is how you have community, right? You need others in to order have to community. Have community, right?
Yeah. Well, so very interesting. Thanks, yeah. Laura, for your email.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and dive into chapter 3 itself. Chapter 3 was called, the title was Memory. And the overarching theme of the chapter seemed to be that our memories have so much of an effect on how we relate to one another and how we form attachments and how we learn to interrelate. And they go through a couple of different ways of describing how that works, but Ryan, what were the couple of different kinds of memory that they discuss in the chapter?
Well, before we get to that, I just want to say I think that if you step back and think about the chapter, like what are they doing with this chapter, in the context of the book, it seems like partly what they're trying to do is they're trying to eliminate a way of talking and thinking about. Transformation or connectivity or communion that is shallow and doesn't deal with the complexity of the human person. And so communion or building strong relationships isn't as simple as just like rearranging some ideas in your head or like reading another book or, you know, doing a workshop. It's like, no, the identity of the person that we are roots deep into places that are actually not touchable directly through sort of conscious, rational thought. And they're trying to help us see a much more nuanced picture of what really is a human being, mm-hmm. And so yeah. To go back to your question, then they really highlight this in the difference between implicit memory and explicit memory. And explicit memory is essentially what we think of as like easily consciously recalled like activities or scenes or scenarios or words or things that were said to us that are like right there at the rational tip
like,
of our,
I remember watching the Warriors game on Sunday.
Right. That kind of thing. Implicit memory is really trying to speak about the unconscious, about the ways that our memory is much more complicated than words and images, that it is more feelings and impressions and bodily sensations that are stored deep within us. And that actually makes up a much more potent and larger portion of what memory really actually is.
So, they talk about the difference between conscious and unconscious memory. Elizabeth, can you explain a little bit more of what unconscious memory is and how that ends up getting formed?
Yeah. So, as Ryan said, there's the unconscious memory is the implicit memory. And you know, this really starts forming even in utero, or it's really this pre-verbal stage of a person's life. So before they're two or three, you know, if you don't have words yet, how are you going to remember things? You're going to remember them in bodily sensations. You're going to remember them in feelings. You can't even think, oh, I watched the Warriors game on Sunday, right? Because you don't have words to, you just have the feeling of excitement or the feeling of terror or the feeling of.
Yeah, so the authors say this kind of explicit memory comes online at 2 to 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
In the class we, you know, on Sunday, you were asking what were people's first memory or when did they, how old were they when they recall their first memory? A lot of them were actually in their late threes or fours.
Yeah, the very earliest was like 2.5.
Yeah, so I mean that makes sense because that's really when your language capacities are strong enough to actually be able to put words to things anyway.
You can verbally process an event, you know, and it stores differently.
So these aren't the kind of memories that you can flip through the file cabinet of your mind and be able to recall, oh, yeah. we got into a car accident when I was 18 months old and that really scared me. Like this sort of gets like through feelings and emotions, this gets sort of knit into who you are as a person.
That's exactly right, John. This gets knit into who you are as a person. And in some ways, that makes it much more important than the explicit memories. Not that explicit memories aren't important, but these are the memories that form up your emotional sense of self. Your implicit memory is, I am a good person. I'm not worthy of being loved. I'm like these kind of like gut feelings that we hold about ourselves.
And they're formational in ways that we can't identify. We can't analyze them.
And it's not just that something happened to you when you were, you know, say 6 months old or something like that. It's that that created a kind of rut in your being that then gets reinforced, or almost it's almost like the being that is being knit together is looking for more of those kinds of experiences to reinforce or deepen that rut. There's something that actually happens to us. So it's almost like the implicit memory is like a series of hooks that are put into you that then other things are hung on later on. And actually that plays out, the authors point out, that plays out into our adulthood the rest of our life.
Yeah.
That those hooks are what we come back to. Where how do those hooks get put in us though? Or how do they get hung in the first place? And that's that, you know, this is the stuff that's pre-verbal and all that, the stuff that the feelings and the things that happen to us. So this ends up being quite important for our whole understanding of how we are as a human being and how we relate to those around us.
They have a whole section in the chapter where they discuss how implicit memory interacts with relationships, how it is formed by the relationships we have as children and how it impacts relationships we have as adults. They state that it's always present. We can't escape it. We can't just turn off our implicit memory for a little while. It's there, and we're not conscious of it. It's implicit, and it affects things. And the only way we can sort of, and this is sort of me synthesizing, and I'm going to use the word synthesize again, because the only way that we can identify its effects on our lives is by synthesizing repeated themes, or by analyzing the story of our lives and see things. Oh wow, I react this way this a lot. There must be something there that for me to be able to try and analyze. Does that make sense, Ryan? Am I arriving at the right in the right direction here?
Yeah, I think that seems like a good way of synthesizing it. And this also is why family systems, you see a lot of the same sorts of behavior patterns passed along as well too, is that you know, one generation sort of sets the ruts, the next generation picks that up and deepens it, and it sets the ruts for the next. It just continues. Mm-hmm. Because we're such we're creatures of mimicry, and our systems are set up by mimicry, which is what they talk about in this chapter and the next one.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that idea. They talk about mimicry and permeability. What is this idea of mimicry, and what does it mean that we are permeable?
I don't know if they're consciously actually drawing on this, but one of the major thinkers of the 20th century and into the 21st century was a guy named René Girard, who talked about mimetic desire. He actually had a theory that all of human behavior essentially could be explained through this idea of mimicry.
Monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah, I mean, in a much more sophisticated way.
Yes, of course.
Exactly, yeah. But I think that there is a lot of evidence for this, that this is how we are as creatures. And so we just can't downplay that, you know. I don't know, maybe you want to say something more about permeability or what they mean by that, Elizabeth.
Well, I think a lot of what we're talking about today goes back to what we were talking about last podcast with the attachment patterns. Because a lot of that was absorbing your emotional atmosphere in the home, you know, whether there wasn't much to absorb. And so you kind of learned to withdraw your emotional tendrils and kind of get an avoidant attachment pattern, or you adopted an anxious attachment pattern. You know, like there's a lot in there of just we are physiological beings, and our emotions themselves have physiological patterns. Like every emotion has a different physiological pattern. And so you pick up, you're around an anxious person and you find yourself starting to become tense. You're on somebody who's very calm, you find yourself starting to become calm. I used to ride horses, and they always would tell us, you know, if you're on a horse that's really anxious, you better calm down really quick, or else your horse is going to spook and run off with you and you'll get hurt, because it's a herd animal and they'll pick up on your tension. And humans we pick up on each other's state. So there's a lot there.
A piece of it that really stood out to me was from page 46. They're defining how this works in infancy. He says, by means of mirror neurons, an infant is able to borrow the emotions of the caregiver. A baby, quote, literally uses the mature functions of the parent's brain to help organize and regulate his or her own functioning. Humans learn an attachment pattern early because of our capacity to mimic the emotions of another. The basic outline or structure of our emotional blueprint is forged in the early months of our connecting because we borrow the emotional state of those who are nurturing us.
Isn't that interesting?
It's fascinating, especially as a parent of a very young child, as an infant, just seeing her, like, I can watch her mimicking me. Mm-hmm. I smile at her, she smiles at me. She's getting upset, I can sort of force myself to be this peaceful presence for her, and it'll help to soothe her and help calm her down. It's really fascinating.
This explains why cultures exist as well. Because cultures are distinctive groups that have all sort of permeated each other. Like, there's a permeability that has created a culture. It also makes sense. I was thinking back to about the ruts created too. Like, language is interesting because how you internalize language is how you then see the world. Different languages cannot be translated directly. Like what you say in one language cannot be, in most cases, be directly translated to another language, because the language shapes how you see the world to some degree.
It's also interesting that they often talk about a heart language. So an emotion is attached to one language, but another language maybe is just cognitively processed. But that's also interesting that
it's neither here nor there, but it's all part of this mysterious way that we're made. And again, back to their bigger picture point, if we don't pay attention to this, we're missing something really substantial about our own human nature and how God designed us, and we're not going to understand what's wrong with us in some cases if we don't actually, dive deep into this stuff.
Right.
Yeah. This is from a different book, but it's a quote that was read in catechesis on Sunday. It's from The Body Keeps the Score, but I just think it helps flesh out some of these ideas further. So the author of this book writes, "One of the clearest lessons from contemporary neuroscience is that our sense of ourselves is anchored in a vital connection with our bodies. We do not truly know ourselves unless we can feel and interpret our physical sensations. We need to register and act on these sensations to navigate safely through life. While numbing or compensatory sensation seeking may make life tolerable, the price that you pay is that you lose awareness of what's going on inside of your body. And with that, the sense of being fully, sensually alive."
Yeah, this is getting into an idea that they talk about in the chapter about being integrated. And I think all of us to some degree are disintegrated. Like, we're not, we know that our bodies carry sort of emotional states in some cases. And so we like almost hive off our like rational experience of life from our bodily experience in some cases. And so you meet somebody and you don't connect with them. It might be because they're not connected to themselves. Mm. They don't actually know what they're really feeling. Many people that I've talked to sort of pastorally, they actually don't know how to feel whole sets of emotions because they block them out. And so in that sense, relating to this quote here, they're not integrated with their own bodily experience of that. And that's partly a coping mechanism in many cases, because people have had, a trauma or a bad experience of some kind, and they don't want to go back and feel all those negative emotions.
Or sometimes they can't, because sometimes people even might want to, but it just doesn't feel accessible.
Yeah, for the sake of their own security or safety early in life, they learned that they couldn't go there.
Right.
Maybe not consciously.
Right.
But they realized they couldn't go there. It wasn't going to work, It would be disastrous to move into that. So anyway, the point of this is just saying that there's like a sense of integration with body. Again, bodies really actually matter with regard to relationships.
And that's because of the idea of implicit memory, because as the title of that book says, the body keeps the score. We carry these things in our body. It's not in our conscious mind. It's implicit. It's knit into who we are as a person, as we were saying earlier. And so if we are disintegrated from our body, I'm just trying to clarify what you were saying, if we're disintegrated from our body, then we are another step further removed from understanding or being able to interpret those implicit memories. Is that...
And emotions is really what this is coming back to again. I mean, the title of the chapter is memory, but memory, I think, is another way of really getting at emotions. And this is my theory, not theirs. I think that emotions are essentially like the Velcro that connects us in many cases to each other. So my emotional state and your emotional state, John or Elizabeth, we connect up, and there's something that connects us. But if I'm disintegrated from my own emotional state, or I'm not connected to my emotions, then I have my ability to kind of Velcro connect to you is extremely limited or not even there at all. And so then we're just kind of like two ideas passing each other, not like persons, you know? So I think that what they're trying to get at, again, this is my own interpretation of them, is that they're trying to help us get in touch with an integrated experience of emotion, which is so vital to relationship. And to do that, you can't just like turn on and off emotions. You have to deal with the whole implicit memory system that is us. And to do that, then, as they say in this chapter, is to get in touch with your story. And story is the way that we in a sense, make meaning of or talk about and integrate the various emotional memories we have in our sort of implicit state. Now, you can't make a story out of everything, because some of these things happen before we have story capacity. But still, stories begin to kind of put meaning or language to what is really beyond language. And it's our attempt to kind of like get into the, what is the term I'm thinking of? The kind of the soup that is, you know, the implicit part of me. I'm getting a funny look on the face from Elizabeth.
No, right, I was just going to say, I want to put a pin in the idea of story, because I think it's a really important, it's where they end the chapter, so I want to come back to it. But Elizabeth had a thought a moment ago, and I wanted to be able to go back to it. I could see
apparently
you.
My face is full,
no, you almost
full
talked
of some sort of implicit memory or something. Yes. But I think I just want to put a parenthesis after what you were saying, Ryan.
Parentheses are... What are you trying to say?
An asterisk, a footnote.
Yeah, I try to put a little footnote to what you were saying, because I think it could be misunderstood that the body is a means to getting to emotions, and emotions are really the things that matter. And I'm not saying that emotions aren't important, but I think that part of what they're saying is that you can't separate emotions from the physical. Like, it's not that one is a means to the other, and that, you know, emotions are the Velcro and we need to pay attention to bodies to get, you know, I don't think it's as simple as that. Even having an infant, you know, it's just so, everything is so physical, right? Like you can't, there's not a ton of like rational thinking going on. But there's a ton of physicality and a ton of like emotionality, and there's a ton of just thinking about this very early stage when implicit memory is really the only thing online, like there really isn't much of a distinction there.
Yeah, so I just keep relating so much of this back to my little girl. There was a couple of nights ago when she was almost inconsolable. She was fussing, she kept spitting out her pacifier, she wouldn't go to sleep even though it was well past bedtime, and I was walking and I was putting my hand on her chest, and that would help a little bit. And I just almost instinctively reached down and put my hand, like cradled the side of her face, and she fell asleep almost instantly. And there was something about, I don't know, the skin on skin contact or the cradling or something about that physical communication soothed her in a way that a shush or a caring glance or a rock just didn't.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot more to it than just, there's a lot more nuance than just emotions or just bodies. It seems like it's both. I mean, of course that's anecdotal, it's experiential, but that's just my little take on it.
Yeah. I just using the picture that you brought up earlier, John, that Danny had brought up in class, of a Hebraic conception of soul. If we even think about the body and the spirit, the more disconnected you are from the body, the less alive you are as a soul, right? Mm-hmm. So like there's this loss of something in there. Anyways, why don't we go back to your pin?
Yeah, we put a pin in the idea of story earlier. I was wondering, Ryan, if you could speak a little bit more to the importance of story. Specifically, why do we tell our stories? What's the goal of trying to learn our own stories and share them with others? Because the authors, they explicitly say that we need to not just know our stories, not just rehearse our stories, but tell our stories. And I was wondering if you could speak to what they were saying in the chapter and what you think about that idea.
I think that they're talking about integration. I think that storytelling is a means of integrating my both the explicit and implicit memory, as well as, which again connects to, you know, spirit and body again. To add another element of spirit and body, that maybe this is more part of the, I don't know if this fits in the body or the spirit side, but the rational side of us, whatever that is, which I guess would be, I don't know how that fits in there again, but that there's an organizing principle to that part of us that is, I was actually looking at an article earlier today that was calling human beings homo narrativus, because we're like so oriented towards narrative, like we're looking for order and meaning and progression through time. And whenever you talk to somebody and you ask them about themselves and they can't tell you a story, their own story very well, that often speaks to is some sort of disintegration, actually, where there's like, they can't quite make sense, that they can't bring their whole self together in some way. And so what the authors are saying, it seems like from my reading of them, is that story plays a really important part in becoming a whole person. And it's interesting that theologically speaking, the gospel comes to us as a story. It doesn't come to us as a set of ideas. The scriptures themselves are an extended story, a narrative. And so it seems like, again, this is echoing, like, the human being is a microcosm of the larger story that God, there is a story again, the larger meaning of the cosmos, you know, that there's a storied nature to everything that's going on here. So they're telling us that we need to remember our story, we need to enter our story, we need to probe our story, they say, and that's the way in which we own and integrate ourselves. And specifically, as you said earlier, John, they talk about sharing your story with another person. Mm-hmm. It's not enough just like to write your own story for yourself. There's some sort of audience interaction with another person that's part of the integrating piece of that.
Yeah, the way they sort of say this, I'll read from page 51 here, is they say, we must share them with one another. We must do so because we are relational beings who are both hurt and healed by our relationships. We must have the presence of others to help us see ourselves well. We need help even with our own story. How does that strike you?
I keep thinking about the time I spent doing research in a psychophysiology lab and just how our emotions are so connected to our autonomic nervous system. So the part of our nervous system we don't have any control over, our sweat glands, our pupils dilating, our respiration rate. I mean, we have a little bit of control over that. Our heart rate, which we have no control over. And just how, but how all those things, if you contextualize events, and you make a story, right? There's like data points and then you kind of like draw a coherence among them, and that's how you form a story. But depending on how you form that coherence, the same data points could mean something vastly different, right? And that changes.
So stories are always interpretations. That's what we're doing. We're interpreting data points to make some sort of logical sequence.
Yeah, because right? our experience, we're biased to our own stories. And you can, you know this because there are stories from your childhood that get told over and over again, and the way in which you remember it could be very different from the way it actually happened. You just remember the way the story's been told.
Yeah, and one or two extra data points that someone else might put in the story differently might can change the whole configuration of how you understand.
No, your Uncle Eddie was there. You're like, no, I thought Eddie had died already. Like,
right, exactly.
Everything changes. Yeah.
But how you tell that story also changes your emotional state, which also changes your physical state. Just your whole person changes depending on what story you're in. Mm-hmm.
So the physiological emotional state depends to a large degree, I think, or just summarizing, on the story. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that makes intuitive sense to us too, right? Just you, I mean, you give this example all the time, Ryan, if somebody's running late and they're an hour late to an appointment and you're just so frustrated with them, and then you learn that their grandma died in a car accident, and
All of a sudden, everything changes.
Yeah.
The narrative is different. You're inhabiting a whole new story.
Right, right.
It's not that it's literally a different story. It's that your interpretation of the data points completely changed. Mm-hmm. And that changes thus your whole bodily state and your whole, you know, emotional world around that.
That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just a practical example. Okay, so to get onto the solution side, which they start to get onto here.
Yeah.
One of the things that they want us to do is to tell our story in relationship to God.
Mm-hmm.
And God being a data point in the story changes the interpretation of the story, changes the emotional state of the story, opens up new possibilities for the story. And so that's where they're going to go later in the book as well, too. And that's where we all have to go with our stories, because there's a great deal of actual tragedy and sorrow and loss and hurt and suffering and trauma that we have experienced. And the only hope for us is to recontextualize that into the story of the gospel, to integrate that into God's larger story. And it gives it a whole different, you know, whole different state and possibilities.
I think it also strikes me how your identity changes depending on what story you're in. So in the first story, so in the example we gave about the person who's waiting for an hour and the person's not showing up, you're kind of the victim in that story, right? The victim of being stood up, or the victim of, you know,
being inconvenienced or disrespected or whatever.
Being in relationship with a very irresponsible person.
Selfish person or something like that.
Wow, yeah. We obviously feel a lot of resonance with this person here at this table. We're really embellishing it. Anyways.
We are on-time people.
Right, but then as soon as we bring in, you know, the car accident or the family member who's died or whatever, all of a sudden your identity changes in that story, you know? It's vastly different.
And empathy for someone else who is suffering, actually. Mm. And that changes your whole emotional state.
Well, I think that all of a sudden you're the supporter, or you're the helper,
changes your role in the narrative.
Exactly. It changes your role in the narrative.
I think this is a good place to sort of tie things off a little bit. I want to share one more quote, because it's where the authors try and pivot this chapter toward the next section. And I think it's a good way of ending things off. They say, whatever your story is, our conviction is this: you are held by God, and God is always listening with a loving ear. God cares about your story because God cares about you. God hears and delights in your joy. God also hears the cry of your heart. Sharing your story with God does not mean painful, shameful memories will magically disappear, but God gets your story. He is a suffering God. And because he has suffered in the Son, our Trinitarian God offers you a way to his heart through your suffering. In your pain, God's sorrow holds you, comforts you, and over time, heals you. It's just beautiful. Well, Ryan, Elizabeth, thank you so much for this conversation. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. We hope to see you, hear you, encounter you. Yeah, you're going to be encountering us. We're not doing anything next week as we discuss a little bit more of the relational soul. Thanks so much.